Hello there, Peabody here. Once again, it is time to take another revealing peek back into history.
What famous date shall I set it to today, Mr. Peabody?
All the way back to 2008. Ruination, the early years.
Welcome back to Ruination, the early years. The show that gives you the shortcut to understanding the complex, chaotic, and incredibly structured world of Big Fatty Online. I'm King, and I'm ready to dive deep into the archives.
And I'm Gail, ready to unpack the structure behind all that madness. Our mission today is to analyze a truly pivotal stretch in the show's history. We're looking at episodes 62 through 66.
Right, so that's the final week of April and the start of May in 2008.
Exactly. And this specific week, you know, it's a masterpiece of tension. You have Big Fatty perfectly balancing his most explicit and scandalous community events with these, like, super mundane, stabilizing details of his domestic life.
And his financial updates, which are surprisingly serious.
Seriously. Financial updates, deep cut TV trivia, it's all in there.
It's the kindergarten rule week, which, you know, sounds so wholesome.
It sounds wholesome, but we know better.
We definitely know better. And that's not even where we start. Yeah. We have to talk about the audio he chose to open this whole stretch of shows with.
Oh my gosh, yes.
That opening sound clip, it's talking about pie-smelling balls, fatty daddy, a reference to leather and a sling. It's like a content hand grenade.
It really is. It wastes zero time. You are immediately plunged into the BFO experience. It's unfiltered. It's maybe a little shocking.
It defines the brand in, what, the first 10 seconds?
10 seconds, tops. That immediate plunge into the visceral and the, you know, slightly taboo, it just sets the expectation perfectly. It's like it grants him a license for all the chaos that's about to follow.
Right.
And what's truly fascinating is that even with this hyper-explicit opener, we are going to see Big Fatty immediately shift gears. He's managing a serious threat of a legal challenge.
A fictional legal challenge.
A fictional one, yes, but still. He's offering this bizarrely detailed party planning advice for a major community event, and at the same time, he's delivering truly deep-cut TV nostalgia.
And all of this is framed by the struggle and then the ultimate relief of just managing everyday consumer issues.
It's the core contradiction. It's what makes the entire show work.
Okay, so let's unpack the logistics of this balancing act. The week begins with Big Fatty establishing his absolute non-negotiable loyalty to his core community.
The Har, which is his lifestyle and social group within the broader RNL network.
And he makes it really clear that this commitment isn't just an idea. It's personal. It requires literal sacrifice, which immediately sets this tone of, like, duty over pleasure.
That's such a crucial establishment of his values. I mean, he notes that on Friday night, he was offered what he calls an all-night sexathon.
A highly desirable opportunity, as he puts it.
Very. And he passed it up. Sacrificing that kind of high-level personal pleasure for a community event, it just immediately establishes his loyalty and priorities within the Har group.
So it wasn't just a casual night out for him?
Not at all. It was a commitment to the infrastructure of his social world.
So let's get into the specifics of that event, the Har event logistics from Friday night.
Okay, so the location was Patrick's Pub, one of his established haunts in Ruination. The goal was charitable. They were selling Jello shots.
And he reports, with that signature specificity of his, that they raised a very modest,
$21.
$21 for the group.
But the atmosphere surrounding this little fundraiser was anything but mundane. Because at the same time, the bar was sponsoring a high-energy, totally chaotic KY wrestling event.
This is where his comedy of observation just shines, because he's describing this scene of absolute high energy rumination.
Right.
Lesbians squirting bottles of KY lube into a big inflatable swimming pool. It's like controlled anarchy.
Uh-huh.
And yet, Big Fatty is positioned at the back, just talking quietly with his friends, Miss Porter and Granny. He's observing the chaos without necessarily being in the chaos.
But he's still dedicated to being present for the Har group's function. That spatial positioning, it's almost symbolic of his role in the whole network.
It really is. And that observation leads directly into one of the week's funniest, most self-aware anecdotes.
The ring girl confusion.
Yes. So Big Fatty, he's seated with his friends. He spots a person walking by in a tube top and Daisy Dukes.
And because this person was carrying liquor bottles, Big Fatty immediately jumps to a conclusion.
He internally assumes they've hired a new skinny lesbian bar back. And starts mentally complaining about the staffing choice.
The confusion gets deeper and he starts, you know, internally grumbling. He says, the last thing we need is a big old olive oil skinny lesbian as a bartender.
But the truth, as it turned out, was so much more complex and hilarious.
The person was actually the regular bartender, just dressed up as the ring girl for the wrestling event.
Complete with the Daisy Duke shorts, a dirty blonde wig in pigtails, which he hilariously described as Pippi Longstockings-ish.
I love that, and it's so important to note. He made sure to clarify, this person was not to be confused with Poopa Lizzie, another figure in the local lore.
He is so meticulous, even in his comedic categorization.
So he had to immediately go and admit he was old and confused.
Yes.
It's this moment of genuine self-deprecating humility that the actual bartender found hilarious.
And that moment confirms that Big Fatty's strength often comes from recognizing when his own rigid expectations are just, you know, blown up by reality.
And then he translates that confusion into relatable humor for the listener. The world of Ruination is always more layered than even he anticipates.
Speaking of balancing contradictions, this kind of extreme social commitment continues all week. By BFO 66, he confirms he'll be attending a horror weekend,
which is his affectionate nickname for events held at the Metropolis Entertainment Complex in Augusta, Georgia, a well-known venue for his lifestyle community.
But the very next day, Saturday, his social calendar included a completely different kind of duty.
Exactly. The structural whiplash is impressive. The logistics for the horror weekend were immediately followed by this high-profile charitable event, the Dining with Friends fundraiser for Low Country Aid Services.
And he was hosting a ham dinner party.
A ham dinner party. You have a public figure managing logistics for a leather club one night and then hosting a polite sit-down dinner for charity the next. It just shows his savvy.
He's building credibility in the mainstream charity world while maintaining authenticity in his nooch community.
For sure. And to prepare for this intensely busy schedule, which includes both Ruination and Polite Society, he had to squeeze in the crucial pre-trip shopping ritual.
At Sam's Club, of course.
Of course. And here he emphasizes his love for a coupon and a good deal, a theme that grounds all the extravagance. This is where we see the consumer, the man who wants value, anchoring the performance artist.
And he had a very specific coupon-driven mission.
A very specific mission. He had a 20% off coupon for the nearby outlet stores, and he was specifically looking for black Caterpillar brand boots.
Which he couldn't find.
He couldn't find them. But the detail of the search, the specific brand, the precise item, the use of the coupon, it's such a consistent grounding element of the BFO structure.
It shows he's a focused, meticulous consumer. Right. He's making sure his audience knows that even amidst all the scandal, he cares about practical things.
Like quality work boots and saving 20%.
Which brings us to a related point. How quickly Big Fatty's life can pivot from the social absurdity of KY wrestling to genuinely serious domestic and financial stability.
Yes.
This is section two, and it's where that contradiction is most vividly realized.
Absolutely. In BFO 63, he details an unexpected financial windfall. He was reviewing his bank accounts, a mundane task that immediately contrasts with the excitement of the previous weekend.
Right.
And he discovered he had more money than he realized, which he notes is not like Big Fatty.
No, not at all.
What's fascinating here is the source, which ties directly into the national context of 2008.
The stimulus check.
His $600 government stimulus rebate had been direct deposited over the weekend. Amidst the financial crisis of the era, this money was meant to spur consumer spending.
And his immediate plan for it, though, perfectly balanced desire and practical restraint.
That balance is so key. He wanted to buy an iPhone immediately, which was the ultimate 2008 status symbol in the podcast network, a huge piece of consumer tech lore.
But he didn't.
He explicitly decided to wait until his cellular contract was up in December for a fancier model. He shows practical, delayed gratification despite this unexpected cash injection.
That's not the typical behavior of a chaotic performer. That's a disciplined budgeter.
And he didn't just save it. He then used a substantial amount of that money to make a major payment on his Ford Explosion.
His nickname for his SUV, the vehicle that features so prominently in his life and travel stories.
And his goal was to pay it off entirely in the next 4 or 5 months, stating there are few things he loves more than not having a car payment.
This financial discipline is the quiet anchor that gives him the security to be so wild in his content.
He is financially stable, and that stability underwrites the entire enterprise.
But then, right after the money talk, we get the serious shift.
Uh-huh. He calls it the kindergarten now, and it's nap time segment.
It's such an abrupt pivot. It serves as this deliberate structural device, a kind of moral reality check that gives him the license for all the explicit material that comes later.
He suddenly transitions to this earnest, high-minded self-reflection. He recommends listeners read Robert Fulghum's book, All I Really Need to Know I Learned in Kindergarten.
Right, encouraging everyone to get back to the basics of life and the golden rule.
And he specifically notes that teasing, even his own, can sometimes go too far, and people need to take a step back and exhale. He's providing guidance to his community.
He's reminding them that while they engage in extreme behavior, they're still fundamentally required to treat each other with basic human respect.
And this unexpected earnestness is a crucial moment for BFO lore. It grounds his explicit persona in genuine human values.
And in a characteristic piece of personal lore, he uses this moment to connect his own history to the philosophy.
Admitting he didn't actually go to kindergarten.
Right. He learned these foundational lessons from Miss Cox, his first grade teacher. It turns this universal kind of Hallmark-esque truth into a specific, personal, and highly memorable anecdote for his listeners.
The seriousness is a brief structural interlude, though, because just as quickly as he got serious, he snaps right back into the hyper-specific consumer reporting with the food report.
Also in BFO 63, this detailed culinary segment acts as the immediate reality check against the high-minded philosophy.
He detailed having Oscar Mayer corn dogs for supper, noting he cooked them in the toaster oven for an impressive 20 to 25 minutes for
maximum crunch.
For maximum crunch. Eaten, of course, with standard yellow mustard.
That is pure big fatty, the obsession with the technical execution for a simple frozen food item. It's not enough to just eat the corn dog. You have to achieve the optimal textural state.
He is a process engineer of lowbrow cuisine.
He really is.
And the testing of new products, which is a structural segment he repeats often, continues here. He confirmed the successful test of Omaha Steaks gourmet burgers on the George Foreman grill, eaten on a French bread roll.
This isn't just reporting what he ate. It's providing detailed, verified product reviews for the average listener.
And the highlight for me, the perfect piece of consumer discovery for this week, was him finding and purchasing dark chocolate M&Ms with peanuts.
In a purple bag.
In a purple bag, which he proclaimed fantastic. That purple bag detail is essential. This dedication to finding and sharing new niche junk food, it's not just a daily ritual. It's an intimacy he shares with his listeners.
It makes them feel like partners in discovery.
It does. And the commitment to the daily routine extends beyond food into, like, linguistic self-correction. We also get the Wednesday apology and lexicon update in BFO 64.
He started by apologizing for posting the Tuesday show too early on Monday night because he was distracted watching Dancing with the Stars.
This shows the constant conflict between his commitment to the rigid podcast schedule and his reality TV obsession. And he often prioritizes the TV.
Then the important vocabularium addition.
He confessed to misunderstanding the word camisole for a long time. He admitted he used it in mixed company, probably referring to it as some sort of outer garment.
Until he saw them for sale at Sam's Club.
And realized it was actually a woman's undergarment. It's a moment of vulnerability showing that his learning process is ongoing and he's willing to share the embarrassment of that realization with his audience.
He's self-correcting his own language in real time.
Speaking of his intellectual curiosity being applied to the world around him, whether it's corn dogs or slang, in BFO 64, he gives us his deep dive into hump day.
Right. He looked up the definition on Urban Dictionary.
He did. And he noted the original benign meaning getting over the hump of the work week versus the modern, often risque implication it had taken on.
And what's fascinating here is that he quotes the definition that structurally defined the entire week around Wednesday, almost like a poem.
Tuesday is the day before hump day. Thursday is one day after hump day, except Friday is woohoo, freedom day.
He's analyzing language as a set of defined structural rules, much like he analyzes the rules of reality television or the logistics of a horror event.
It's all systems analysis for Big Fatty.
And his listener map updates in BFO 64 confirm the ever-expanding global reach of the BFO brand.
Yeah, he welcomes new listeners like Turniphead from Toronto, Ontario, and Straight Bob from Melbourne, Australia.
Who is a self-proclaimed Bostonian.
A self-proclaimed Bostonian. And Big Fatty's immediate instinct is always to try and connect these distant community members. He wonders aloud if Straight Bob might know Brian from Boston.
He's always making those personal geographical connections. The audience isn't just statistics to him. They're interconnected nodes on a growing network.
But the network lore got decidedly messy via the eBay Pants drama, which was delivered through a voice letter in BFO 64.
This is a crucial piece of lore about the blurred lines between Big Fatty's content and commerce.
Yes. David, the host of That Blue Jeans Guy, called in to confess that he was the one selling Big Fatty branded leather pants on eBay.
Which is significant because it shows listeners attempting to co-opt and commodify the BFO brand immediately.
David explained he was simply trying to get rid of his own really big pants, but strategically figured they would sell better with Big Fatty's name attached. It was an unauthorized attempt at branding and profit.
And he apologized and promised to immediately remove the auctions.
Concluded by telling Big Fatty not to sue, because he didn't have any money anyway.
And Big Fatty's reaction here is essential. He treats the entire thing as part of the community narrative and a joke.
He manages potential intellectual property issues with humor, rather than real legal action. It's a classic piece of network negotiation, wrapped in an intimate, funny voice letter.
Now, let's pivot from humorous legal threats to the full-blown narrative chaos of the scripted threats.
Yes. In BFO 65, the legal drama escalates dramatically with the return of a beloved recurring character bit.
Big Fatty announces that Connie McComley's attorneys have left a message.
Connie, being the airline agent he feuded with over lost luggage in previous episodes, that mundane travel feud has now been weaponized into a full-blown legal narrative.
The execution of this fictional lawsuit is just a masterclass in podcast parody.
The call featured two lawyers, Tony Scarlett from the firm Dewey Cheetah and Howe, and Solomon Schwarmer Kinman, who was conference calling from an Atlantis cruise ship.
The specific details of this scripted chaos are critical to the humor.
Tony Scarlett admitted he was a genuine fan of Big Fatty's show, completely breaking the fourth wall, but begged Big Fatty not to reveal this to Mr. Kinman,
saying he would be ruined if his partner knew he listened to the show.
And then we get to the star performance. Mr. Kinman, conference, calling from a cruise full of men in Speedos, leaving this increasingly ranting message.
He complains bitterly about the cruise ship environment. He demands Big Fatty answer his calls, and he escalates his threats dramatically, promising to get money, money, money from him.
It's a perfect blend of high drama, legal parody, layered with extremely specific insider gay lifestyle commentary about the cruise environment. This segment just proves Big Fatty's capacity for complex, ongoing narrative storytelling.
And amidst the high drama of the fictional lawsuit, he still has to manage the very real prize winner logistics.
In BFO 65, yeah. Big Fatty finally connected with Tim from Terminally Single, the listener who won the coveted 100 voice letter prize.
The prize was a shirt, but the logistics quickly turned into a transactional joke.
Tim required a 2XL shirt, which Big Fatty noted cost extra, prompting the immediate classic Big Fatty joke.
Tim, you're going to get the shirt, but Big Fatty better get a look at the baby's arm.
It is the transactional nature of his prizes. It's a reward for the listener, but an expected, intimate, boundary-pushing performance in return. The prize is never truly free.
It comes with the price of participation in the joke.
And the explicit content and boundary-pushing consistently generate audience feedback, which Big Fatty feeds off of. He referenced listener Scotty calling in specifically to express how hearing about Big Fatty's undies being sent out for free made him vomit while at work.
The show is literally causing physical reactions in his audience,
which only fuels the explicit content loop. That reaction is validation that he is pushing the envelope correctly.
Moving to section four, let's look at the structured, predictive segments. The reality TV and quiz program updates are always essential for demonstrating Big Fatty's keen eye for entertainment structure.
In BFO 63, he summarized the Big Brother 9 finale. Adam won the season, but the true focus was on the fan favorite.
Crazy James.
Crazy James, distinguishable by his pink mohawk, who won the vote for favorite jury member.
This confirms Big Fatty's aesthetic focus. He's less interested in the strategic winner and more interested in the entertaining outlier.
The aesthetic element that disrupts the norm. He also critiqued American Idol, noting Paula Abdul was a little cray-cray, and discussing the timeline for the finale. He predicts the remaining girl contestant will go home next week.
He's always placing his aesthetic and observational bets based on what he perceives the audience appetite to be.
And he finished the updates by expressing excitement for two upcoming shows, So You Think You Can Dance.
Because Big Fatty is a dancer who loves crumping.
Naturally. And the Mole, which was reappearing in the first week of June, he has his finger firmly on the pulse of summer reality programming.
That leads us to the week's most memorable and professionally instructional listener interaction.
The ultimate horror room request.
In BFO 66, Michael of QCA Connection called in with a pressing problem. He needs pointers to create an ultimate horror room for the massive Gay Days event in Orlando,
which was coming up in early June. Michael recognized Big Fatty as the ultimate authority on structured ruination and needs expert consultation.
He specifically asked what Big Fatty looks for in a good horror room, noting he has about a month to prepare.
This elevates Big Fatty from just a content creator to a professional logistical consultant. He is providing a precise, itemized blueprint for controlled chaos.
And Big Fatty delivers.
He delivers. He provides specific, explicit horror room pointers that weaponize his personal knowledge and experience.
First, the crucial non-negotiable logistical rule.
Do not move the hammock out of the yard. Big Fatty will bring his own. This establishes his personal comfort and requirements as paramount to the event planning.
Then comes the structural and supply advice, which is intensely explicit and clinical.
He recommends rubber sheeting or plastic flooring for easy cleanup treating the scene like a professional venue where liquid management is essential.
And the mandatory supply list.
Oh, the supply list.
Yeah.
A case of 3-pound cans of Crisco industrial lubricant procurement, if you will.
Non-latex gloves, explicitly sourced from friends in the medical field, again, emphasizing that professional angle.
And a good douche system. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's not just a party. It's an itemized blueprint for a specialized high-intensity event.
Complete with procurement instructions for medical supplies and industrial lubricant.
He is providing professional-grade logistical advice for niche events, proving his expertise is unfiltered, functional, and deeply detailed.
And he wraps it all up with the ultimate self-aware joke. If Michael really wanted to make it horrifying, he could simply invite Big Fatty over.
Which confirms that his persona is the final, most potent source of horror or chaotic entertainment. It transcends the need for external props or supplies.
The chaotic party planning transitions immediately into the broader community mobilization with the Gay Day announcement.
In BFO 66, yes, Big Fatty teases a very special announcement of a special event happening Saturday afternoon of Gay Day, requiring RSVPs due to tight space. This shows the shift from planning for one listener to mobilizing his entire community base for a massive public event.
He mentions other key events, a podcaster listener dinner on Friday, and Ryan from The Way We See It hosting a boot nanny on Sunday afternoon.
He's acting as a social director for the entire community.
And then he closes this intensely explicit chaotic week by issuing a direct contrasting challenge for the listener.
To do a random act of kindness on Cinco de Mayo.
Which was that Monday. Providing that final layer of moral grounding that keeps the show tethered to shared human decency.
That pivot to the random act of kindness challenge is the perfect summary of the BFO paradox. He can give detailed instructions for a sex party one moment and demand you participate in philanthropic goodwill the next.
Now let's move to the essential structural foundation of the BFO show, the Memory Lane Music, where he provides a cultural literacy test for his audience by diving deep into classic TV themes.
This segment is where Big Fatty solidifies his role as an arbiter of pop culture nostalgia.
Monday 428 featured the theme from Hollywood Squares.
Specifically, the 1998-2004 version, hosted by Tom Bergeron and Whoopi Goldberg. And Big Fatty's trivia connects Bergeron to his then-current gig on Dancing with the Stars.
He's always keeping the trivia relevant, tying nostalgia to the present reality TV landscape.
On Tuesday, 429, we got a truly deep cut, the theme from Star Trek. Deep Space Nine.
Which ran from 1993 to 1999.
And Big Fatty demonstrates his encyclopedic knowledge here. He provides detailed context, explaining it was the first Next Generation spinoff not set on a starship, but on a static space station, Deep Space Nine.
Orbiting the planet Bajor. And he detailed the political setting. The station was formerly Tarok, nor controlled by the brutal occupying Cardassians.
He lists the key characters, confirming his mastery of the lore. Commander Benjamin Sisko, the Bajoran First Officer Kira Nerys, the shapeshifter Odo, and the morally flexible bartender Quark.
This detail is crucial. It shows he's not just playing a theme song, he's sharing a lifetime of invested fandom.
And he's testing the listener's own immersion in geek culture.
The Wednesday 4:30 theme was the instantly recognizable Will and Grace.
Right, which ran from 1998 to 2006. He called this one the easiest one Big Fatty has ever played.
And his subsequent commentary acts as a boundary and a playful litmus test for his target audience.
If you didn't recognize it, I am taking away your gay car. It reinforces the show's identity and its specific audience through shared cultural anchors and humor.
And here's where the structure allows Big Fatty to weave in his own fan fiction history.
Thursday 51 was the theme for Melrose Place, a quintessential 90s spinoff set in West Hollywood. He first noted the absurdity of the show's representation,
pointing out that despite the West Hollywood setting, the series only managed to feature one core gay character, Matt Fielding.
He then used the theme to reference his own past dirty stories. He wrote about characters like Matt Fielding, played by Doug Savant, who was then starring on Desperate Housewives, and the hunky character Jake.
And he mentions a specific detail from his fan fiction.
A fictional bar called the Mule's Tool. This is him folding his creative past into the structural trivia segment, forcing the listener to guess the exact qualifications for entry into that fictitious bar.
It's a piece of interactive trivia based on his own unpublished fan lore.
And finally, Friday 52 brought the theme from Party of Five,
a dramatic show about five orphans that ran from 1994 to 2000. He notes the lead actors, Scott Wolfe and Matthew Fox, whom he calls delicious.
But to showcase his commitment to obscure trivia and his own high bar for cultural literacy, he didn't just play the main theme.
No, he played a second, unrecognized, early theme for the show,
challenging his audience's deep knowledge even further. He demands their attention to the minutiae of cultural history.
And he closes the week with a final call to action that is purely logistical and demanding.
Big Fatty noted he was out of voice letters and issued a direct command. Y'all listeners, get off your ass and call OK.
The content machine needs fuel, and he's not shy about demanding that the community actively participates in its operation.
This week is just a perfect encapsulation of the BFO paradox and why the show holds such structural integrity.
Big Fatty is a host who can negotiate the humorous fallout of branded eBay pants and give explicit step-by-step professional advice on where to buy Crisco for a high-chaos sex party.
And yet he still uses a government stimulus check responsibly, pays off his Ford Explosion SUV, and preaches the golden rule directly from a children's book.
A book he didn't even learn from in kindergarten.
The stability of his domestic and financial life provides the necessary grounding for the utter chaos of his online persona.
That's absolutely right. The commitment to the domestic and the financial stability, that's the anchor.
And if we connect this to the bigger picture, Big Fatty strategically uses his most intense and explicit chaos, like the itemized list for the ultimate horror room, as a way to build community and trust.
He takes the personal and the grotesque and makes it not only functional but instructional,
providing a blueprint for shared experience and trust within the horror group. This high degree of specificity is his currency. So for you listening, the provocative thought is this. Think about the most awkward, specific, or embarrassing niche in your life. Could you, like Big Fatty, weaponize that specific, unfiltered knowledge to create your own reliable, highly intimate structure?
That's the challenge he constantly sets for his audience. It's fascinating.
I'm King.
And I am Gail,
King and Gail. Crucially, tune in next weekend for the newest episode of Ruination, The Early Years.
Well, we hope you enjoyed today's trip down memory lane on Ruination, The Early Years. Join us again next weekend. We'll see you then.